is Matthew Wayne Selznick. And this is Sonatotum, episode 79. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be speaking to you about such things? Well, my day job is helping authors and other creators bring their works to fruition, to market, and to an audience. I've been doing the DIY independent publishing thing since, well, depending on how you count it, 2005 or 1998. I've been a podcaster since 2004, and I've got about a dozen works on the market. So every other episode of Sonatotum, we have a conversation with another independent creator, usually a writer. And this episode, it's Monica Cross. Now, Monica is a multiple award-winning playwright residing in Northwest Wisconsin, as I speak to you today. Today, by the way, is April 12th, 2023, and I'm coming to you from the Lush and Lavish studios of MWS Media in Southern California. Anyway, back to Monica. She is a multiple award-winning playwright residing in Northwestern Wisconsin. Her one-act play, Cyrano on the Moon, has been produced at fringe festivals in Tampa and Minneapolis, as well as several virtual productions. And Wonder of Our Stage, her first full-length play, was the winner of the 2018 Players New Play Festival in Sarasota, Florida, and went on to be included in their Summer Sizzler series in 2019. Monica is a proud member of the Dramatists Guild and the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association, and her plays can be found on the New Play Exchange. And of course, more about her and her work can be found, you guessed it, at monicacross.com. This was a pretty interesting conversation that I had with Monica back on January 20th, 2023. If you don't know much about the world of independent theater, this is a pretty neat perspective. Let's get right into the conversation with Monica Cross. I always like to kind of officially start with a couple of relatively open-ended basic questions. So first of all, what do you create?
I am a playwright predominantly. And so I write short plays, full-length plays, predominantly in the speculative fiction or historical period drama genres, and often combining those two in some way.
Cool. And I want to talk a little bit about the sort of sub niche of speculative fiction theater. But before we get kind of into that stuff, so that's what you make. Why do you create?
I actually just wrote an artistic statement that sort of started off with, I was studying Shakespeare and found that I had opinions that I couldn't express in scholarly academic prose, which is very, artistic statement-like. But I write because I watch a lot of theater, and as I'm watching theater, there are just stories that I see that I have opinions on that I then turn into their own plays, like adapting classical work either as like sequels or like from a different perspective. And so a lot of the things that I write come from a place of really wanting to get people thinking about what they're seeing from a new perspective.
And like an annoying four-year-old, I'll ask why.
I've found that if I have that question or a thought, someone else is also having that thought. So like one of my plays that has been produced several times, the most common comment that I get about it is that it's the catharsis for the source material that it's based off of that they didn't realize they needed.
Mm, yeah.
What? Go ahead and elaborate on that. Use the specific example. Yeah.
This play is called Cyrano on the Moon. It is a sequel to Cyrano de Bergerac by Rostand, and it takes place about 15 years after the final act, which takes place 15 years after, you know, the first four acts, and it imagines the afterlife of Cyrano, where he finally gets to talk to Christian and he gets to talk to Roxanne. And it's really from Roxanne's perspective, so that, you know, she has this giant speech where she's like, you know, what if you'd actually just told me? and she gets to confront him about it. But I also sort of wrap things up in a way that gives everyone a nice feel good ending, even though throughout much of the conflict, it's like, why didn't you just communicate?
Yeah. Excellent. I love it. I think that's with any media, right? I think we'll often take something in and ask those questions. Like you said, it's the catharsis we didn't know we needed, because a lot of times it's like, well, that was great, but this whole thing didn't need to happen if only everything hinged around one person being stupid or obstinate. And sometimes that's just, you know, plot armor, as they say, you know, the story had to happen. So the author or playwright or whatever it might be just opted to ignore that basic common sense now and then.
Well, like Cyrano de Bergerac, you know, it's this classic love story, but it's also, I say that it is a play not about a man with a large nose, but a man who thinks he has a large nose.
Yes.
You know, so many of the characters around him are like, you are so lovable. And he's like, no, I'm completely unlovable. Right. And how many of us have felt that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more of his own self-esteem than anything else. Yeah, yeah.
But also, like, he's held up, you know, or he holds himself up, and the play very much so holds him up as this, like, ideal tragic hero. And it's like, well, actually, no, a little bit of therapy and we could have had a very satisfactory ending. So I don't give them that satisfactory ending, but I give them, you know, sort of the next best thing. I give them the chance to redeem themselves later.
My first novel featured a protagonist who, sure, he looked a little different and noticeably so, but the abilities that came along with his physical appearance should have carried him along, you know, but because of his appearance, his self-esteem was so low that he became the self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's like, well, you know, nobody's going to like me. So yeah, no, nobody liked you, and everybody picked on you. And if you had just kind of woken up a little bit or listened to the people who were telling you, you're all right. Yeah, exactly. So now I do want to circle back. Tell me a little bit about the sub niche in theater of speculative fiction. And maybe I'm misinformed. Maybe it's not that uncommon, but tell me about it.
Right. Yeah. So in 2014, I attended the first International Science Fiction Theater Conference. This was an academic conference on the study of science fiction theater. And, you know, it was kind of a small conference. Everyone who attended came with their like lit review of, I have been searching for decades for science fiction on stage, and it only exists in this small corner. But there wasn't a lot of overlap over the presentations. And what we kind of all sort of realized is we all had corners of a map that was much bigger than we had realized. Uh-huh. And the keynote was the director of the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Science Fiction talking, sort of theorizing about what like a speculative fiction theater would be. And he coined this term that I just absolutely love called replicant theater, very much so based off of Blade Runner.
Sure.
The idea being that just as replicants are so good at blending in that sometimes they don't even know that they're human, science fiction and like the natural conventions of theater have so much in common that they don't quite realize that oftentimes there are things that in any other medium would be considered speculative fiction that on stage doesn't register. And I was just actually discussing with someone a play by Susan Laurie Parks called Fucking A. The play is about incarceration. It's about abortion. It's also about like racialized violence. It's also kind of a musical, and it takes place in a world that is vastly different from our own. And the person was like, oh yeah, that I was having this conversation with, they were like, oh yes, this is a piece of speculative fiction. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. I taught that play at one point and I did not even register it as, because a lot of times on stage, the classic example that I always go back to is in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Oberon stands on stage and says, now I am invisible.
Right.
He may make a gesture. He might have a cloak. There are all these things that he could do. But there's nothing in the stage direction that says that he has to do anything, which is partially like a feature of the way Shakespeare was writing. But like literally the act of saying, now I am invisible, and then having all of these characters interact in front of him without acknowledging him makes him invisible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the cool thing about theater, is that the conventions are set up in such a way that when you step out on the stage, you can be anywhere doing anything, and you manifest it simply by stating that that's the case.
Yeah.
So that is to say that there are a lot of things that might be science fiction or fantasy that are often not even considered as such. And then there is actually a growing number of playwrights who are writing specifically in the speculative genres intentionally. And there are some theater companies that are dedicated to that work. There are some theater companies that are just dedicated to new works that incorporate some of those plays into their programming. And then there are some theaters that, if it looks too high fantasy or high, you know, hard science fiction, then they're too worried about how it's going to play for the...
Right. Can we sell tickets for this?
Yeah. Can we sell the tickets for this? But there are quite a few sci-fi plays out there. One of my favorites right now is Mr. Burns by Anne Washburn, which takes place after some sort of apocalypse. And it is all about characters trying to remember episodes of The Simpsons without being able to look stuff up on the internet. And sort of how a piece, you know, like her goal was, she wasn't setting out to write a science fiction play, she says. She said her goal was to, well, she didn't say science fiction play, but she said that her goal was to examine what would happen to a piece of popular culture after the moment that that piece of pop culture exists in.
Right.
And in order to do that, she basically had to create a world where electricity no longer exists.
It almost immediately made me think of the librarians in Fahrenheit 451 walking around in the woods, reciting classic books to each other so that they can remember, you know. But instead, it's, okay, this is the episode where Mo finally gets sober. Here we go.
it's such an interesting play because it deals with like the economics of the situation. They have a line booth where like you can come up and be like, this is a line that I remember from this episode, and they'll pay you for it.
Right.
And
added to the knowledge, added to the database. Right.
Someone, you know, like at one point someone's making a comment about like, you know, comedy versus catharsis. And someone's like, well, why don't you just go and join the West Wing? and you realize that like they are doing reruns, live performances of reruns of The Simpsons, but that other companies are out there doing other iconic shows.
That's fantastic. Literally fantastic. As we talk about this, I'm struck by, you know, kind of, well, of course, the sort of agreement when you go to the theater is suspension of disbelief. You know, you are expected to believe this is a drawing room, that you're expected to believe that that what you're looking at is a road with a tree, you know, thinking of Waiting for Godot, or, you know,
right.
And we automatically just, we are ready to believe whatever the performance is going to present to us.
Sure. And I think so that Waiting for Godot is one of those great examples of like, is that science fiction?
Right.
It's definitely out of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't present any overtly scientific or fantastical elements, but it does have a sense of this is an alternate reality.
Absolutely.
And there are other plays that are in sort of the absurdist genre that have like characters with unnaturally long lifetimes, or, you know, things that do sort of feel more overtly speculative. But once you get outside of realism and naturalism on stage, there's an element of the fantastical in all of them.
Yes. And I think also, too, though, it's like any really great or good narrative works, it's not about what's happening. You know, what's happening, the plot, the through line, whatever, is not what the thing is about, you know? So
right.
Absolutely, you know, metaphor and that flexibility of reality, I would think, and I'm, you know, and I'm no theater expert by any means. I've seen my share, but not as much as I would like. Right. But I think that, again, that's kind of the expectation. That's the deal. I'm sitting down, I bought my ticket, I'm sitting down, and I expect to be taken somewhere else. And where that somewhere else might be doesn't matter, because ultimately, and this is, I'm speaking for myself, when I leave a play that has affected me, it's just that, it's affected me. It's not, wow, that was a great story. It's, man, I have felt something. The agreement is you're going to manipulate my emotions for a while, and I'm going to love it and maybe learn something or reflect on something or see something that I had not seen. And again, I'll speak for myself, ideally within myself, you know, that it's a reflection back to the audience. So, yeah, as we're talking again, I'm like, well, of course, there's a lot of speculative fiction and or fantastic fiction in theater. And like you said about that conference, everybody's on their own little island thinking, I'm alone. Right, when the whole right. sea between them is the medium that they're looking for.
you said something in there that I want to touch on, and that was, you know, about how the experience is about how the piece affects you. And I went and saw a production of a play called Marjorie Prime, which I can't think of the playwright's name at the moment, which I try to always have. But Marjorie Prime is about robots that are so human-like that you can't really tell. And you replace your loved ones with these robots, and then you tell them stories about themselves, you know, in the first or like second person, right? Like, remember that time that you went to the movies with me? And they're like, oh yes, I went to the movies with you. And you feed them the details, and then they take on that personality.
Right.
And the entire play is sort of about how effective that is or not. Can you replace a person with something that shares their memories? And at the pre-show speech at this production, the person who was sort of giving this pre-show lecture talked about how, despite it being a work of science fiction, it was really about humanity. And I laughed, and I'm sure that you and most of your listeners like also chuckle at this,
well,
this
despair. Duh.
Like you know, no, actually, it's because it's science fiction that it's talking about humanity. And, you know, like that, to me, is one of the big obstacles to overcome as we're trying to program these plays and get speculative fiction onto more mainstream stages, is this idea that, like, oh, science fiction is about special effects.
Right.
And remind people, no, it's still about who we are as people.
Right. And I guess that must influence, well, you know, as you said, that's you probably have to pitch it that way. It's like, we're not even going to talk about, when we go in there, we're not even going to talk about any of the fantastical elements. We're just going to say, this is what this is, you know, this is what we're attempting to do here. This is focusing on the humanity of the story rather than, yeah, it's about a robot. And, you know,
right. Well, you know, the thing that I try to do in my writing is look at how I can create a story that could only exist on stage. Mm. You know, for instance, Marjorie Prime, almost all of the actors are going to be playing both the humans and their robot counterparts. Mm-hmm. So visually for an audience and like in reality, there is no difference.
Right.
But through the story, we come to realize that there still is something innately wrong. And that's different than, you know, like when you have a person living and breathing 20 feet in front of you, that's different than watching a film adaptation of the same story, because there is now a film adaptation of Marjorie Prime that you can watch. And it tells the same story, but I think it has a different, you know, and it's done the same way, right? Like an actor is going to be playing both the human and the robot that is based off of them, but it's going to hit different because you're not feeling them in that space with you.
Yeah, I totally get it. As you say, with the play, you're in the room. You can feel them on a pheromonal level.
Right.
You know, and that even in a play like that, that specific play, I'm sure that's part of the subtext. It's like, this is the same person, but it is not the same person. You know, there's the theme of the play, right? You know,
that is exactly the theme of the play.
Yeah. And what makes them human or not, and who decides, and right. Yeah. There's so many opportunities. And I mean, to me, that's what storytelling is for. You know, to talk about what it means to be human at any level. And, you know, that's maybe an overly generous brush to paint with, because you can analyze anything from the most trite B movie all the way up to, you know, something in high regard for the ages and say, yeah, that's about being human because of blah, 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 blah. But I think that's when it's most effective. That's the goal, is to maybe explore and better still challenge us in thinking about ourselves, well, as thinking creatures. Right. And to maybe redefine for us, you know, what it means. Yeah. So that sounds very fucking cool. And I'm pleased. I mean, if there's a conference for speculative theater, then that means that there's an audience, right? It's big enough to talk about, then it's big enough to be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the conference happened all of twice or maybe three times. I only got to attend the first one, but it's definitely like growing and evolving. People are doing more things. But I used to go to a lot of academic conferences. I've sort of shifted away from academia and more into doing more than studying.
Sure.
But, you know, I would go to sort of generic theater conferences and have my sci-fi panel. And, you know, at lunch or, you know, after dinner, people would be like, oh, and what are you doing? And I would explain, and they'd be like, that's not really a thing, is it? So there's... It's a little bit of a both. Like there is a growing audience, and then there's also still just so many people who are unsure or skeptical of how that would even work, which fascinates me, because we are so willing to believe so many things on stage, and then the things that we're not willing to believe is fascinating.
Well, to be fair, though, I mean, and maybe a little critical, the conferences you were going to where you're having these encounters were academic conferences, and silos are kind of
certainly
built in. I've had sort of an undercurrent of a thought while we've been talking about this, about the acceptance of this. I wonder if the increasing acceptance and prevalence of science fiction, fantasy, all the things that used to be considered nerd culture, becoming so mainstream and so accepted, I wonder if that's trickled down or trickled up, depending on how you want to gauge it, to theater goers being more accepting of that kind of thing.
There's the subgenres of like science fiction and fantasy and horror, and then also like just geek theater.
Yeah.
And a great example of that would be She Kills Monsters by Wai Nguyen, I think is how his name is pronounced. She Kills Monsters is about a girl's D&D like homebrew module. Like she has died in a car accident. Her sister has found it several years later and decides to play through it as a way to reconnect with her sister. And so we get to see her, and she's based all of the characters off of like people in her life. So we get to see her and all of the people, all of her friends then become trolls and,
right,
you know, they fight Tiamat at the end, and it's so much fun to see, because, you know, they have basically LARP gear, right? Like giant, you know, foam swords and axes. And so you get to be a part of that like nostalgia, because it's also like sort of set in sort of Second Ed era. So it's definitely got like a huge like nostalgia factor, and it's such a lovely play about like coming of age and sisterhood told through an experience with D&D.
That sounds amazing. And it makes me think, as primarily a prose writer, I have such a problem with genre in general and genre restrictions, and in particular, the lit RPG subgenre of fantasy. But that play, that would make an amazing lit RPG book. That's what that stuff should be about. Instead of, oh, we fell into a game and it's the imaginary is real now. No, make it mean something. No, that sounds lovely.
Right. Yeah. Like there's a great moment, you know, sort of towards the climax and without sort of spoiling stuff, but like the DM just stops it and is like, wait, I can't answer these questions for you. Like she is gone.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful moment to get to stage. And that's a play that gets done fairly frequently and by fairly mainstream theaters, because it is that perfect blend of nostalgia and like just mainstream enough, and it sort of couches the fantasy elements within a sort of more realism based narrative of the sister dealing with
The very universal, very very meaty topic of dealing with grief and loss. Right. Absolutely. I'm afraid we could talk about just this stuff for the whole hour. I want to move on to the other sort of two pillars of both the podcast and the discussion. So making stuff is the first pillar. The second pillar is finding success as you define it. So talk about how you personally, as an artist, as a creator, as a playwright, how do you define success for yourself?
That is such a good question. And that's something that I feel like I'm constantly redefining. I was listening to a different podcast recently where someone was talking about like making it. Mm-hmm. And that feels very cut and dry. Whereas I feel like success is more of a journey to go on for me, because the end goal of writing any play is a production, right? For me, simply getting produced is one measure of success. I try to find success in the little things. There is a playwright that I really admire who talked about like he does this thing where he breaks down the numbers of like how many world premieres are there per year, how many playwrights are there per year, how many new plays are being written. And he basically says if you're getting like one world premiere production every 10 years, then you're on average.
Right.
And that's if like the big name playwrights out there weren't getting multiple of these, you know, every year. So rather than looking at, well, how much are the royalty checks for this, or how much am I being produced? How often am I being produced? I really try to focus on like how people are responding to my work as a measure of success. I had the opportunity to have my first full-length play produced the summer right before the pandemic, which I've still been being produced virtually. And there's a lot of things that have gone on with that, you know, theater has managed to pivot and survive and is now coming back to a certain extent, rebounding as much as they can. But during that first production, it is based around the character of William Shakespeare. And so as such, I talked to the director about casting, and we cast a woman in the role of the alchemist John Dee. Mm-hmm. And then I did this makeup for her that made her look like the portraits that exist of, you know, with the big white beard and all that sort of stuff. And she has a line, or, you know, John Dee has a line that says, "I have been both mother and father to him," which is in reference to this automaton that has been brought to life. And I had audience members come up to me afterwards and just comment on it. What an interesting and how good it felt to see a woman playing a man, you know, in a sort of like inverse of the Shakespearean.
Right. The Royal Theater.
In a part that has this dual responsibility of being both mother creator and like father patriarch.
Yeah.
And it's those moments, hearing the audiences respond to things in that way, that to me is like the greatest measure of success. Because that means that, you know, back to the early question of like, why do you write this? Like having audiences respond and say like, yeah, that had an impact on me in some way. Like, that's exactly what I'm writing for. So that to me is the greatest success.
It's starting to be a recurring theme among the people I've just talked to this week, is how we are affecting others with our art, and especially perhaps when we affect folks in ways that we didn't expect, when we learn things about our works that we ourselves did not know until others experienced them. And it's gratifying for me, because I have sort of a go-to platform that it's not really art until someone other than the person who created it has experienced it, that it's a collaborative experience between, you know, the reader and the writer, or the audience member and the playwright, or, well, in case of a play or a film or anything, of course, it's not just the playwright. It's everyone involved in creating that experience. And without them, without that audience, without those readers, whatever it might be, we don't really know what we've done.
Definitely. And with theater, that is brought home so clearly, because a play is not a book. When I hold the thing that I have written, that is a script.
Yeah.
Right. It's part of a play.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really become the thing that I've written until it's on a stage in front of an audience. And there are so many things that I learn when I get to be in a rehearsal room, which sometimes happens, sometimes doesn't. It depends on the theater setup. It also depends on the proximity.
Sure.
That's one of the things that I've loved about the move to virtual theater and like Zoom performances, is being able to be halfway across the country and still be able to attend rehearsals. You know, so often there are things that went one way in my head, or questions that I hadn't considered when I was writing, actors coming up with like motivations for characters that are like, yes, of course, but I had no idea that that was right there. And so that's like a lovely part of the experience of being a playwright. It is sort of seeing where your collaborators take the thing that you've written. And then, you know, as you mentioned, like it, we don't know what we have until we get it in front of an audience. You know, part of making theater is that it doesn't really become the thing that it is meant to be until the audience is there, because the audience, even in a play that is not interactive, even in a play that like there is a very solid fourth wall, a lot of my stuff has kind of a soft fourth wall to it. But even stuff that has no, you know, a very clear separation between performance space and audience, the audience being present changes the feel of the show.
Yeah.
And that's even more palpable when you have things that are, I don't really write interactive theater, but I write theater that has what we call like audience contact, or where you sort of acknowledge that there are people in the space with you and speak directly to them.
Well, and to say nothing of the fact that every single performance is a different and ephemeral experience.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, sure, they could be videotaped or whatever, but the people in the room are never going to have the same experience. Even if they go the next night, you know, it's not going to be the same thing. And that's something very, very special. So that's great. It sounds like you're very fulfilled and gratified by what's happening with your work. What's the next, not that it is a hierarchical or a stepped pyramid or anything like that, because as you said, you're embracing the small things, the small successes, the collaborative reward of the experience. But are there any higher goals that you're looking for? Any what, like, okay, well, next I want to reach?
Oh, certainly. So in theater, there is already a hierarchy to theaters, right?
Right.
You know, there's
little warehouse theaters all the way up to Broadway. Yeah.
Right. There's like the myth of Broadway. If it's not in New York, then it's not happening. You know, that sort of myth that persists. But there's also, just even with, you know, as you said, community theaters, there's college theaters, there's professional theaters, there's LORT, which is the League of Resident Theaters. And so that's like an entire tier of theatrical experience a lot of like Lort theaters or the theaters that plays that are on their way to Broadway go to. So they test them out regionally and then they send them to New York. So I definitely have like made it to rungs in that hierarchy and would like to see it move forward, right? Like I've had plays workshopped at professional theaters. I would like to eventually see a full production at a professional theater. As of right now, the majority of my work gets done at colleges, which are fantastic because they are so much more interested in like exploring. So they're willing to take a chance on work that pushes boundaries in a way that other theaters might not be willing to take that chance.
Well, I imagine there's much less or no concern about reputation or, of course, commercial viability or, you know, any of those things that when there are bigger stakes applied can, you know, right or wrong or consciously or not, influence people's decisions and influence people's commitment and all of that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that they don't have those concerns, but they have those concerns are much dampened, you know, they're dampened to a certain extent. So that's one direction of like growth that I'm looking for, seeking that full professional production, looking at the next sort of tier of theater up and moving towards that. Another direction is for the majority of last year, I always had a production on the horizon, which was great.
Yeah.
So like every time a show closed, I knew exactly what the next show was going to be and, you know, where it was, all the way from like a middle school theater class that wanted to do my adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of the Red Death.
That had to have been delightful.
Oh, so fun.
So gratifying, too. I mean, that's okay. Sorry, that tickled me so much. Go on.
It was great. It was nowhere near me. I did not get to see it, but I got to see photos of students like creating the masks for the masquerade. Amazing.
So cool.
How much fun. And then all the way up to a virtual production of Cyrano on the Moon that was remounted and actually had some like slight editing and was able to like go out to anyone on the internet who wanted to see it right at that time. It had a limited run online. So, you know, that is one metric of like, okay, I always had something going on for the entire last year. Awesome. Now maybe trying to up that frequency or
be booked out for the next 2 years or
exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are those metrics and I definitely have that, you know, as you mentioned, you know, described pyramid in my head. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is I work towards that, but I also like, I moved like almost the entire length of the country last year, which had such an impact on my writing process. I really had no idea how much moving was going to impact, but I probably lost about 3/4 of the year.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Right. Even though the move itself only took like 3 months.
And was part of that just getting reused to the state? I mean, not the literal state, but the actual the state of your environment, the getting comfortable with.
Yes, yeah, getting unpacked was a huge part of it. Because like, yes, there was the packing part and then there was the moving part. But then there was also the unpacking part and getting settled. But then there was also the rhythm portion of it.
That's what I mainly meant is getting emotionally settled, you mm-hmm. know, like, okay, I live here. I can create here.
Yeah. Well, and also I have dyslexia and ADHD. And so that impacts my writing in very curious and interesting ways. And so like, I don't have a set writing process because if I had a set writing process, like, you know, like just like, I don't have like a standard morning routine because mm-hmm. if I had a standard morning routine, something that I had to do like in a particular order every single day, I would never even get out of bed. that's just how ADHD works in my head, at least.
Yeah.
And so my writing process is this sort of like, it's about getting jazzed. It's about connecting with the project. And it's about like sort of balancing even things like what am I going to eat during the day with finding the time to sit down and write. And all of those things being thrown out of whack, you know, but it really, this move was so big that I had to create an entire new routine for my life.
Right.
And so it took way longer than I thought it would to find where writing fit into that, to the point that I kind of got a little concerned that, like, when is that going to happen for me?
Yeah.
And then right at the moment that I was, like, most disillusioned with it, finally it all clicked. And then I sort of had this explosion of writing in the last quarter, which was really great. So I'm learning to balance my expectations and my goals with life, you know, because if all I'm doing is looking at the absolute numbers and not taking into consideration the things that are going on in my life around my writing, then I'm always going to be beating myself up about why am I not producing enough? Whereas if I take into consideration, you know, this holistic approach of like, okay, I know that things are going on that are interfering with this, then I can find the value in the work that I am accomplishing.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what allows me to continue to find success, is really focusing on being able to get snowed in and do 20 pages of rewrites and be like, oh, this was an amazing day because, like, I got snowed in and I've got all this time to sit around and write like that.
And you actually did sit there and write instead of doing something else.
Yeah. I mean, it was luckily like this. I have always loved revisions. Some people hate revisions or drudge through revisions, but the way that my brain works, the first draft for me is really the backbone of the idea. And so, you know, I like to say that rewriting is writing.
Oh, absolutely.
So this play that I'm currently working on, it isn't speculative in any way, but it is Shakespeare related. And I'm also working with a dramaturg who is a person that researches, but also like new works dramaturgs can help with the development of an idea by asking you the right questions and helping you clarify your own thoughts.
Almost like a developmental editor in the prose world.
Very much so, like that.
Yeah.
And so I'm just working one-on-one with this dramaturg, and, you know, she'd asked me a bunch of questions, and it has just opened up the play. And luckily with this project, most of the time, you know, you write, you've got the strong beginning and you kind of maybe get, you know, your endings and maybe not quite there. This play, I've got the ending. Like, that was the thing from the get-go I knew was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's in the perfect place. So I'm rewriting the beginning to get it to that ending in a much faster, more concise and more explicit way. So it's one of those happy times of like, okay, I'm so excited about the project and just happened to be gifted this time that I could just sit down yeah. and go. And I almost didn't want to like stop for dinner. You know, I was like, I'm just on a roll. Why do I have to eat?
You've already answered this to a great degree, but the other sort of the third pillar of the show is, you know, it's making stuff, finding success as you define it, and staying healthy and sane in the process. And you've already talked a lot about that, but what are some of the things that knowing yourself and knowing how you work and knowing how your brain works, what works for you? What helps you get in those flow states that you had during your snow day?
The first thing that I want to say before I sort of respond to this question specifically is that, like, there is no right way, right? Like, so many people say, you know, you've got to write every morning, or they've got to sit, you know, you have to put in so many hours, you need to do, you know, like, people will say, you've got to do this.
Those people are wrong.
The thing is that, like, every person is in a different place in their life. Mm-hmm. Every person has a different set of brain chemistry. Every person's going to relate to the work differently. And so anytime someone's like, what does it mean to, I'm always like, it's what works for you. Like, listen to everyone, but only keep the stuff that's working. I feel like over this past year, as I struggled to reestablish my writing process, I learned a bunch of things about how my specific brain works. So like someone not too long ago on Facebook asked about like keeping momentum writing as a playwright with ADHD. Mm-hmm. And someone sort of unthinkingly responded with like, if the story grabs you enough, you'll keep writing. And I was like, okay, that's literally not how an ADHD brain works. So I'm just going to stop you there, because things like rejection sensitivity, which is something that is being more and more recognized as a part of ADHD, is your brain sort of erroneously tells you that that no one likes you. And I think that also translates into your art, right? And that sort of couples with the way that an ADHD brain doesn't really store short-term memory properly. So as I'm writing, I will literally forget what I've written already. I'll know what I'm writing, but the things that have come before will be kind of fuzzy until I reread it. And if you couple things getting fuzzy with the erroneous idea that people aren't going to like it, that's a recipe for automatically deciding halfway through the process that the play is just not worth it.
Right.
So what I've found works for me is when I start to feel myself get to that point, if I just go back and reread what I've written, I will be terribly thrilled.
Because it's all new in a way.
You know, it's like, oh man, I actually got that section right.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's keep going. So I've started to find that there are tricks that work for me that help keep the writing positive and keep me from getting stifled in my work. And really, like, the practice of giving myself that grace, right? The way that I would tell a friend, right? Like, you are doing so much great work. Like, you can take a break. You know, you don't have to be producing every minute of every day. It's so much easier to give other people that advice than to give it to yourself.
Oh, yeah.
But I have found that I can give that advice to myself. And I do. So by focusing on keeping those goals very small and finding, you know, like, I'm a member of, or like, I've joined a database called the New Play Exchange, which, if you are interested in looking up more science fiction, fantasy, horror plays, I highly recommend this database because it is the largest repository for plays by living playwrights.
Wow.
And it is largely unpublished work because in the theater industry, plays don't get published until after they've had several productions. So if mainstream theaters aren't producing science fiction plays, then they're not going to end up in print.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
So this database, and you can search by genre. So you can search, like, I'm only interested in science fiction plays, and I'm interested in 10-minute science fiction plays because I want to be able to read, like, it on my coffee break. And there are a ton of them out there. So this database has a system for recommendations. So even though my plays are unpublished at this time, a majority of my work is up on the New Play Exchange. And that's how I get a lot of the productions that I get, is through theaters finding it there. And by having this recommendation system that they have, it's not a review, it's not a critique. It is literally, I would recommend this play to a friend. Let me write about it in 100 words or less or something like that. So every once in a while, I will go on and there will be a new recommendation of something that I've written, sometimes by a friend or a colleague, sometimes by people I do not know. You know, whether, even if it's a friend, it's like, oh, my friend took the time to read my play and like it. Great. I love that. It is so delightful when it's someone out of the blue.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of those small things that I can do for myself. That's not this great full production in New York. It's a very small, like, hey, your work meant something, that keeps me going. And so that's, I think, staying healthy, staying sane. It's about giving myself the grace that I would extend to other people and taking the time to really take pleasure in all of those little things that are going to give me that boost of confidence and reassurance to keep going.
That's really great. I love the concept of this New Play Exchange, this database. I'm a little envious. I wish there was something like that for all forms of narrative fiction. And I completely understand why there isn't.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean I don't wish for it. And I completely get what you're saying. You know, it sounds like, to distill it a little bit, accepting and allowing small validations to matter, you are still reaching people with your art. You're still triggering that collaborative thing that we talked about earlier is still being triggered. And it doesn't matter if it's 30 people in a shoebox theater or 500 or 1,000 in a full production kind of thing, or one or two people every couple of days on this database. These are people that had not been touched by your work, and now they are, and it keeps happening. So absolutely, that's wonderful soul coal, you know, to fuel the engine.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets back to your same approach to success, you know, about making sure that you're accepting that the little things matter and that they're all cobblestones, right, on the path. They all push the journey forward. Very, very healthy of you, I gotta say.
This is something that I started cultivating, you know, in the last couple of years, because I think, you know, so many people, myself included, are so bad at taking compliments. Mm. You know, we're like, oh no, you know, when someone says something nice, right? And I got to this point where I was realizing that, like, I wasn't feeling the compliment. Mm. I was immediately rejecting it.
Mm-hmm. It's safer that way sometimes.
Yeah, and it's something that I don't know where the sort of catalyst is that causes it, but it's so pervasive. Mm-hmm. So many people are like, "Oh, I can't take a compliment very well." And it's like, yeah, it's a skill that we've got to learn. We've got to teach ourselves.
I have a theory about that, but I want you to continue.
Okay, yeah, but so really taking the time to sit with those compliments, to really accept that validation, to recognize that when someone is saying that something has had value for them, that you can really listen to that.
Yeah.
So this has been years of moving in that direction.
Yeah.
So you have a theory on that. I'd love to hear.
Well, okay. So when we gloss over compliments or accept them but don't really digest them, right? I think that allows us to stay in our personal status quo. I think it keeps us from entering into a personal space where we have grown, where we are better than or have higher potential than the space we're currently living in. And that's why I said it keeps you safe, you know, because so long as we're not challenging ourselves creatively, personally, in any way, really, there's no risk. And our brains are stupid. All our brains want to do is keep us safe so that we make more us. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Our brains don't really know any more than that. And so when we take a compliment, in a way, that is a threat. It's a challenge to grow. Mm. And growth involves risk, and risk involves danger. And to our brains, all danger is the same, basically. So there's, I think, for some people, you know, and maybe it's just that specific artistic mindset, whatever that might be. But I think I understand not taking a compliment or not knowing how to take it, but not knowing how to digest it, to get the nutrition from it.
Yeah, I think that there's something to that, because one of the things that I noticed when I started to realize this about myself was that I was inventing reasons why a compliment might not be genuine or might be overblown or might be...
Oh, you're just saying that because...
Right. And that, I think, is a sort of protection, right? Like, oh, I am not going to really put myself out there because this compliment is coming from a biased source. And if my work actually gets out there to an unbiased source, then the reactions will be different. They'll be devastating. Yes. Versus being like, okay, I have an audience. That audience is here. Mm-hmm. I should be writing more towards that. And then we'll see if, like, other people are excited by that as well. You know, accepting that my work, at one point I was going to like a weekly or biweekly meetup of playwrights who you could hear your work read out loud. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the comments that I would get were, your work is very literary. And I was like, yep, that is the case. and it was very much so not a compliment in the way that it was being said.
Yeah,
But what I realized is, like, okay, my writing might not be for the, you know, 1,200 seat houses. Mm-hmm. But if I can have a 50 seat or a 99 seat theater packed with people who are really eager to hear what this story is, then that is a higher concentration. Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm writing plays for the people who do want to really interrogate this historical moment from a different perspective, or who want to envision a world where robots quote Shakespeare, or where Shakespeare was a robot. And the people who are interested in that particular subgenre, as niche as that is, are going to get really excited about it, right? And I will take that any day over a living room drama, which I dunk on living room dramas a lot, and I shouldn't. I have not yet read them, but there is an entire sci-fi trilogy that is set in a living room. It's about alien invasions, but it's set in a living room.
Right.
So like, you can still do interesting things in a living room. It's just the,
it's not your thing.
Yeah.
Since I write in, well, I like what I like, and it doesn't always fit in genres. So yeah. rather glibly, I started saying I make things for people who like the kinds of things I make. But more and more, you know, I'm talking to people who, like you just said, you would rather have that. The folks who don't get it, it's cold to put it this way, but they don't matter. They're not the people you're trying to talk to.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about Twitter as a platform, right? Like, I can tweet at the playwrights and the novelists and that have written the things that impact me. And I can be like, oh man, I read a pirate romance that involved a character who has dyslexia and I feel so seen, right? Like, and that novelist will respond and be like, ah, thank you. And having platforms that allow us to break down, whether it be Twitter, whether it be the New Play Exchange, whatever it is, that allow us to break down the strata between artists and their audience, and to be able to just, like, I remember years ago, I saw a horror movie and was like, and tweeted about the horror movie being like, this was so grotesque. And one of the people who made the film wrote back, like tweeted back and was like, yeah, we had a huge problem on set with like how grotesque it was. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah. No, like that being able to have those interactions, I think is one of the things that makes it easier to find that audience and to find the art that you can be that excited about.
Totally agree. I have the same experience with various authors, and growing up, I was such a huge comic book reader. Mm. And now all those folks who are still alive, almost to a person, I'm in contact with, and either on Twitter or Facebook. There's one guy who was an editor for Marvel Comics, and we don't know each other from Adam, but he sends me a birthday thing every year.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah,
right?
That's great.
You know, and I can write, I can say something in passing to the creator of a lot of the iconic Spider-Man characters from the 70s, and he's there because we're all just folks.
Right. Well, like, one of my favorite people on Twitter is J. Michael Straczynski, right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
I love Babylon 5. And I know that he has done so many other things across so many mediums, but just listening to him talk about the actors that worked on that series, many of whom have now passed on, like, right. You know, A, there's some melancholy there, but there's also just such beautiful anecdotes about that creation process for something that is so meaningful to me. I love that show.
I'm grateful. As much as it can be a horrible force for not so good, I'm pretty grateful for social media as a concept, especially as a creator. So as someone who's been doing this for a while and has found kind of a rhythm, and you have been able to define and accept the meaning of success for yourself, and you're doing the work, if you could distill what you have learned for yourself down to the obligatory pithy thought, is there a bumper sticker slogan for your creative life?
Yeah, I'm actually going to steal this from, because that's the best part of playwriting, right?
Yep.
From a playwright, Simon Stevens, who he wrote the stage adaptation for The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. That's what he's like most known for. He's got many amazing plays beside that. And he was talking about like writing with the idea of like an audience in mind. And he was like, if you're focused on, is this producible? Is it stageable? You're not going to get anywhere. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But the thing that he said was, the only thing you should be thinking about when you're writing is the thing that you wish someone else had written so that you could enjoy it.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
If you're writing that, then you've succeeded. And then, you know, usually there will be someone else who also really wanted to see that.
Yep.
I just think that, like, that was such a lovely sentiment, and it's been sticking with me. And that's exactly what I strive to do, is to write the plays that I want to be able to see. And so that's my one little, like, pithy statement that it is stolen, but with a tribute, you know, I've attributed it.
Yes. Yeah. So it's okay. Well, and of course, that's why you read or heard or saw that somewhere, and people are going to read, or, you know, they're going to hear you saying it here. That's the whole point, you know. It's going to resonate. Well, Monica Cross, thank you so very much. This has been a blast. I've learned a lot about the play writing and producing world, and I'm so happy that you were able to share that and share your experiences for Sonatotum.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, if you've enjoyed this or any other episode of Sonatotum, I've got three things that I would love for you to do for me to help show your support for the show. The first thing is, if you haven't already, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, please subscribe for free to Sonatotum. Just click that subscribe button for Sonatotum wherever it is that you might have heard this episode, wherever it is you get your podcasts. Next, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, I hope you'll take just a moment to rate and review Sonatotum. Tell the world why you enjoy the show and why other people should listen to it and subscribe for free. And finally, if you'd like to go the extra mile, you have the will and the means, I hope you'll consider becoming a patron of Sonatotum and my other creative endeavors. For just $5 a month, not only will you be a member of the Multiversalists community of writers and readers and creators, you will receive all kinds of special access, perks, and exclusive content, not least of which is the uncut, unproduced edition of every episode of Sonatotum. Just go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron or visit patreon.com/mattselznick and pledge just $5 a month to support the show through your patronage. That's it. If you can do one or two or all three of those things, you'll be really helping the show and helping me reach more people with the Sonatotum mission of making stuff, finding success, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Thanks. Gang, before we take another moment, I would love to thank my Multiversalists member patrons, Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, and Ted Leonhardt. These fine folks have been contributing and supporting Sonatotum and my other creative endeavors for some time now, and I'm so grateful for their persistent and consistent patronage. As you just heard, if you'd like to join them, it's just $5 a month to become a patron. You can go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron and find out all about all the various perks and privileges that come with your gracious support. So what did you think of the conversation with Monica Cross? I'd love your feedback. While you're over there at mattselznick.com, just click on the podcast link in the menu and look for this episode, episode 79. Scroll down to the bottom and you can leave a comment with your thoughts on this episode. Of course, you can do that for this and any episode over there at mattselznick.com. If it's easier for you, just send me an email at matt@mattselznick.com. If you prefer to have a little time-shifted conversation, just record a brief audio message, maybe on your phone, and email that to me at matt@mattselznick.com. And because this is an interview episode, if you have questions and comments for Monica Cross specifically, I will make sure that she gets them so that she can be part of the conversation too. Next episode will be a spotlight episode. Every other episode is a solo spotlight episode where we talk about making stuff or finding success or staying healthy and sane. So stay tuned for that. Once again, I want to thank my guest, Monica Cross. You can find her at monicacross.com. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.